Somebody is in for something this morning. I don't know if you guys are just in for a really long sermon or if I'm going to pass out up here. I'm not sure which. You guys can pray for me this morning. I'm just a little bit under the weather. Adding to the sort of that insurmountable, adding to all of that, we add the insurmountable difficulty that I just finished this 6-week series. And the grandpa said, "Hey, Richard, why don't you summarize all of that in a single Sunday morning service?" So I just want you to know anything that happens this morning is his fault. All right? And we're just operating on that principle. Let's move forward. So, what we've been doing in Sunday school for the last 6 weeks is looking at doing a series called "In the Fullness of Time," which is also, as happens by startling coincidence, the title of the Sunday school or the title of the sermon. See, I'm still in Sunday school mode. All right. If I say anything really inappropriate, somebody throws something at me. We get a little fast and loose in Sunday school time sometimes, and I'm going to try to behave myself for the morning service this morning. But we've been doing a series called "In the Fullness of Time," and what it is to walk through history from Genesis, from the garden, from the tree, to the manger. And we'll talk more about where that phrase comes up from in a moment, and we'll give you our text. If you want to go ahead and turn over that direction, go and turn your Bible to Galatians chapter 4, stick a bookmark there, and then turn it to Ephesians chapter 1, and you'll be good to go. So I wanted to start out by telling you a different Christmas story than maybe the story that you've heard this morning. In 53 B.C., all right, the Roman general Crassus. Crassus was one of the triumvirate. He was the wealthiest man in Rome. He's one of the first triumvirates. So there were three guys: Julius Caesar, we all know him from he did a lot of famous things. Pompey, who had a city named after him, and then Crassus. And these three guys were the most powerful, most wealthy, most influential guys in Rome. As it happened, Caesar and Pompey were pretty accomplished generals, Caesar especially, and they went out and they did some pretty significant things. And so Crassus starts thinking, you know what? My peers are going out and they're conquering nations and they're, you know, doing all kinds of glorious things for the Republic. I'd better, you know, start pulling my load here so it looks like I'm as capable as they are. Well, as it happens, and I think most of us, you know, confession time here. One of my very favorite movies is The Rogue, Richard Burton. All right. It's set around, that's the Richard Burton one. This is the other Robert Taylor one, which I don't like as much. But it's a movie called The Robe. It's an old movie. It's set in the time of Christ, and it's about the tribune or the centurion who presided over the execution of Jesus Christ and his subsequent coming to the gospel and everything else. It's a fun movie. There's some sword fighting. I enjoy it. I like Richard Burton. But one of the things you get when you watch the old movies or you read the history books is sometimes you get in this mentality that back in the day, at the time of Christ, that there was Rome and that was pretty much it. That Rome would pretty much rule the modern world. And while it's true that they definitely had the primary dominion over Western civilization, Rome was not the most powerful empire, or at this point in time, the most powerful republic in the world. There was another empire that could match them troop for troop, man for man, citizen for citizen, country for country, king for king. And it was known as the Parthian Empire or the Persian Empire. And so in about 53 BC or so, a Parthian army invaded what was then Roman-controlled Mesopotamia. And so Crassus left Rome, got an army together, and marched out to sort of counterattack the Parthians on their own turf. And they would eventually meet for the first time. These two great nations would meet for the first time in battle at a place called the Battle of Carrhae. And General Crassus had about 43,000 men, about 43,000 troops. The Parthian army, on the other hand, was led by this very enigmatic, very charismatic guy. We don't know a lot about him. He was called the Cyrener. Now, if you guys wanted to start calling me something else from this time forward, pretty much anything, well, I won't say pretty much anything, because that gives you guys entirely too much leeway. But really, instead of calling me Richard or Mr. Richard for some of the little guys, if you just start calling me the Richard, I would be okay with that. Because any name you give someone, it's been scientifically proven, is more awesome if you preface it with a definite article, all right? So there was this guy in Persia. We don't know anything about him. He does have descended from him, was a very famous Persian family, also called Serena. But there was this guy by the name of the Serena. And Greek and Persian historians tell us that he was the handsomest, tallest, most awesome person in the entire Persian Empire. And I'm actually not making that up. That's what everybody said. They said he was the tallest, he was the handsomest, he was better at killing people and better at fighting than anybody else was. He was brilliant, he was awesome, he was the foremost man of his time. And he's a commander of cavalry, of horsemen. We don't know a whole lot else about him, but what we do know is that the Parthian high king of the time, take that phrase, high king, stick it in the back of your mind, because we're going to come back to it. It's going to be very important. The Parthian high king, or the Persian high king of the time, told the Serena, said, take some cavalry out and buy some time for me to get my army together. So he says, go out and take some cavalry, and I want you to harry and harass and just kind of keep an eye on Crassus's army until I have time to raise a force equal to meet the Roman legions that are coming against me. And so the Parthian army, led by the Serena, went out with about 9,000 horse archers and 1,000 cataphracts. A cataphract is a heavy cavalryman. A Parthian cataphract was like the tank of the ancient battlefield. It was a guy on a horse, and the horse and the man were covered from head to toe in heavy armor. The cataphracts carried very large swords and long steel lances that they would use to engage their enemies. And so he had about 9,000 horse archers, 1,000 cataphracts, and they met out under the hot desert, out under the hot, sweltering Mesopotamian sun one day in 53 BC. And Serena says, you know what? They've got 40-something-odd thousand. I've got 10,000. I think I got this. And so as the battle lines were drawn, Crassus thought, all right, they're going to charge me. It's going to be a cavalry charge. The best way to handle a cavalry charge is to stand very still with a long, sharp stick out in front of you, because horses don't like that, and it'll just disrupt the cavalry charge. And so everybody, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get into forming a hollow square, and it's going to be sharp 26 all out on the outside, and there's going to be some gaps that the horses can run through. It's going to be sharp 26, all your spears on the inside, and this is going to withstand the Parthian cavalry charge, and they're going to break on us, and then we'll just keep on marching, and we're going to show the Parthians how the Romans do it. So he forms his legions up into a hollow square, and the Serena gets out there, and he says, you know what? You guys just hang in there for a second. And so he calls back to have some camels, and the Parthians, they had dromedaries and Bactrian. Again, Bactrian is a two-hump camel. Dromedary is a one-hump camel. He had a very long supply chain made up of people on camels that they would use to carry provisions, carry arrows and whatnot to the front lines. And so he sent for a bunch of drums, and he surrounded the entire, with his 10,000 man army, he surrounded the entire Roman line with these drums, and for a day and a night, the Parthians beat the drums. And if you can imagine, you're just this little Roman soldier hanging there with your sharp, pointy stick out in front of you, and you're waiting for the cavalry charge, and it's hot, and it's blistering, and you're cut off from supplies, and all you can hear all day long is the incessant beating of drums. The next morning, as the sun is rising, the Parthians cover their armor in heavy cloth and ride into battle. And when they get about 100 yards away from the Roman lines, they tear the cloths off, and the Romans are blinded by the light of the sun shining, reflecting off the highly polished armor of these cataphracts. And the battle begins. And here's the Romans sitting here waiting for the cavalry charge that they just know is going to come. And the Parthian army forms up and starts riding around the entire Roman army in a giant circle. You see, the Parthians did have 1,000 heavy cavalry, 1,000 cataphracts, but they also had 9,000 horse archers. And there are two things that horse archers are good at. One is shooting you from a long way away, and the other is running very fast, and they can do both at the same time. In fact, historically, it's known as a Parthian shot when you're riding on horseback. And advance one more slide here for me. There we go. All right, this is a Parthian shot right here. And this is a modern-day Persian reenactor in full horse archer regalia performing a Parthian shot. This is where you are riding a horse, and as you're riding the horse, you turn around and you shoot behind you. This means you can both attack your enemy and run away from him at the same time. This is big news in ancient warfare. And so the Parthians run around, gallop around the Roman army in a giant circle, firing arrows, killing Romans left and right. And the Romans don't have anything they can do about this because the Parthians have powerful composite bows that can penetrate their armor, that can penetrate their shields. And so the Romans form up, two more slides forward here. The Romans form up in what is called a testudo or tortoise formation. And that is, they basically all do this. They have shields on top, they have shields out in front, they have shields on the sides, and they say, all right, we're just going to sit here. We can't charge them because they're moving faster than we are. We're going to sit here and we're going to wait for the Parthians to run out of arrows. Well, the problem is that the Parthians brought a whole bunch of arrows and that they had more camels bringing more arrows. And so eventually, the Romans were broken. The Sereno charged them with his cataphracts, and the Roman legions were destroyed. In the aftermath of the Battle of Carrhae, nearly 20,000 Romans were killed, and 10,000 more Romans were captured. The Parthians lost approximately 100 men in the battle, and Crassus himself would die just a few days later when attempted truce negotiations went sour. This was the worst defeat in Roman history since the time of Hannibal. And it began a decades-long war between the Roman Empire and the Parthian Empire. Now, you're sitting there right now and you're thinking, well, Richard, I thought you were going to tell me a Christmas story. And I am. Sometime about 48 years later, around 5 BC or so, according to Bishop Usher, who was a historian, he said, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, was born of the most blessed Virgin Mary at Bethlehem in the fullness of time. And although these two events seem disjointed and unrelated, hang in there with me, because I'm going to tell you just what exactly this all has to do with Christmas. Because both of these events, and obviously the birth of Christ being the final event, have something to do, have a part. And what both the Apostle Paul and Bishop Usher and other historians refer to as the fullness of time. I asked you a moment ago to turn your Bibles over to the book of Galatians, and it's there that we're going to start reading from this morning. Galatians chapter 4, verses 3 through 5. In the same way we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. This is Paul speaking to Jewish believers at the church of Galatia. In Ephesians chapter 1, verses 7 through 10, he says something similar, but now he's talking to a different audience. And by the way, as we're reading the Bible, as we're interpreting Scripture, it's very important to know who the audience is that the words were intended to, because that tells us something about their meaning. And Paul says to the Gentile believers at the church at Ephesus, in him, that's in Jesus Christ, we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of his grace, which he lavished upon us in all wisdom and insight, making known to us the mystery of his will according to his purpose, which he set forth in Christ as a plan for the fullness of time to unite all things in him, things in heaven and things on earth. Now, there's a lot more truth in each of these verses than I can get into this morning. But I've been fighting a little something all week, and I thought I was over it yesterday, and it's back today with a vengeance. And Linda has threatened that if I am not able to finish this morning, she has a throat spray for me. So you guys pray that I will be able to finish without the aid of awful throat sprays. Snake oil, that's what I meant to say. Essential snake oils. Okay. I'm giving you guys a hard time. All right. So there's a lot of little detailed truth in here, and really we can take those verses in the context of Galatians, take those verses in the context of Ephesians, and get so much more from them than I'm going to do this morning. But for time's sake, I just want to give you the overarching principle here, and that is that the phrase in the Bible, the fullness of time, it refers to God's plan through history to bring about the redemption of all mankind through the person of His Son, Jesus Christ. And that this time, that this history that is being filled starts at the fall of man. It starts in the garden when our first parents ate of the fruit and doomed us all. And it culminates in the birth of Jesus Christ, who is born to die and to be raised back to life forever to free us from the effects of not the curse, but the fall. And we'll get there. What makes time full? Well, all of history is about redemption. And as we study history, and as you, most of the families here, not all, but many of us homeschool. All right. If you're schooling at home and you're teaching, or even if you don't homeschool and you're trying to teach your children history or give them a biblical perspective on what they're learning in school, all of history is about redemption. And ultimately, history, whether it is past history or even things that are much more recent and much more contemporary, ultimately, all of history needs to be studied and understood within the context of God's redemptive plan for the world. So we're going to see this morning, and I'm only going to show you a few highlights. Grandpa's asked me to summarize 6 weeks of lessons on highlights, and so what you're getting this morning is going to be the highlights of the highlights. All the previous weeks of this study, except for this morning's, which should be up there soon, are out on the church website, and I would greatly encourage you, you know, if this is something you want to pursue further and study further, to go out there, avail yourself of those recordings. But what we want to do this morning is we want to look at some highlights of how God superintends a number of different factors, a number of different parts of culture and of history to bring about the birth of His Son. And we're going to see Him do this, starting with the promise of the seed of the woman, which happens at the curse, moving forward in time to the preservation of the line that would bring about the seed of the woman, the biblical covenants, the line of Judah. And then we're going to end this morning by looking at how God used Gentile nations to bring about the fullness of time. So what makes time full? How was time full when Christ came? Well, first of all, time was full for mankind. The story of Christmas really starts in the book of Genesis, chapter 3, at the fall. You see, it is the events of Genesis 3 that necessitate and that foreshadow and that will ultimately bring about the first Christmas. Starts out, everything is perfect, and God creates man, and He creates him for two primary purposes. There are many reasons for which God created us. I firmly believe in the deepest part of my soul that God never does anything for just one reason. And I think maybe in this life, if we're lucky, if we're blessed, that God will show us maybe two or three of the reasons for which He does things or for which He allows things. But ultimately, God is an infinite God, and He has an infinity of purposes in everything that He does and everything that He allows and everything that He ordains. But man is created for primarily two purposes. The first is to give glory to God. Give glory to God. That's the purpose of all creation, but man was also created for something additional to this. You see, all creation is created to give glory to God, but God did not make the monkeys, God did not make the beetles, God did not make the stars and the sun and the moon to experience an intimate relationship with Him. That is a unique thing for which we as human beings alone were created. We are relational beings, and so that means when things are damaged, when things are broken by sin, the first things that are broken are not physical, but relational. So God places man in the garden, and he gives him a work to basically keep it and tend it, and he only gives him one to do, and you know how this goes. Genesis chapter 2. It says, "And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, 'You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in that in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die.'" So the moment, so God tells Adam, don't eat of this tree. Adam and Eve are made, they're there to live in the garden in perfect communion with one another, in perfect relationship, communion with God. And then you know the story, the serpent comes along and he tempts Eve. And she is deceived, and Adam comes, and Adam is not deceived, but he chooses to sin anyway, the Bible tells us. And our first parents sin, and at that point, something happens called the fall. And at this moment of the fall, three things happen. First of all, remember, human beings are relational creatures. So the first things that break, we're not primarily physical, we are actually primarily spiritual, we're primarily relational. So the first things that break when sin is introduced is not our bodies, it's not the creation around us, it's our relationships with others. And so we see that fellowship is lost with God, that an enmity is created against God, and that our shame, the shame of our sin, in this case, the shame of Adam and Eve's nakedness and their sin is revealed. That's what happens at the fall, and it's very important for you to understand Christmas and for you to understand why God is doing redemption in the way that He is doing. It's to understand that at the fall, the things we lose are intangible. They are relationships. We lose communion with God and we gain the shame of our sin. This is not the curse, which happens just a little bit later in Genesis chapter 3. So the curse happens, and this is where God deals out some very specific judgments for some very specific people. First of all, He curses the serpent. The serpent and all animals of that same kind are symbolically cursed to go on their belly. The woman, we see that the process of fertility and childbirth, which was originally intended by God just to bring great joy, now also brings great pain and sometimes sorrow and suffering. We see that the relationship between a husband and a wife is not the way it should have already been, because of the way that husbands and wives will now react to each other after the fall. And we see the curse on man. We see that the whole ground, the whole earth is cursed. It's poisoned. There are thorns and thistles and things that are poisonous, things that will kill you. Work itself is broken. It's cursed so that it's not fun anymore, so that it's hard, so that when Friday afternoon comes, when Friday afternoon comes at my office, there's just a collective spacing out. All right, if I actually try to schedule any kind of a meeting or any kind of actual work with my client on a Friday, they'll say, don't schedule that on a Friday. I don't want to do work on a Friday. And so we'll reschedule it for sometime in the coming week. Excuse me. So work itself is cursed, and it is hard, and it's not just a source of joy, but it's now sweat and sorrow. And then, of course, there is death. God said, from dust I made you, and to dust you will return. But in the middle of all of this, in the middle of this whole process of cursing the serpent and the woman and the man and all creation, God gives us hope. You see, in the middle of His curse on the serpent, God says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. This is the first inkling that we have in the Bible that something is coming that's not here yet. That this whole building crescendo, this building momentum in the Old Testament. This is where it starts. This is what starts the ball rolling with this one simple statement that one day the seed of the woman, which biologically should be an impossibility, is coming, and when he comes, he is going to crush your head. And everything else that happens all the way to the book of Malachi, all the way into the book of Matthew, when Jesus Christ is born, is building up momentum to the manger. Because someday, Jesus, the seed of the woman, was going to come at the very first Christmas, in the fullness of time, after all of history had built up to it, and he was going to free us from the burden of, not the curse, but the fall. Let's rewind just a minute. What did we lose in the fall? We lost our relationship with God. We lost oneness with Him, and we were covered. We were, our eyes were open to the shame and the nakedness of our sin. What did Jesus change with the cross? After Jesus died on the cross and came back from the dead, alright, people still get sick. People still die. Work is still hard. And there are elements of the Christian life, there are elements of the redeemed life, which make the curse more bearable. Don't get me wrong. But the curse hasn't been lifted yet. What Jesus came to fix the first time was the effects of the fall. It was the fact that my relationship with Jesus, my relationship with God was cut off, and my eyes were open to the shame and the nakedness of my sin. And then Jesus comes and he says, "No, Richard, let me take that for you." So Jesus came at the very first Christmas to free us from the fall. And Jesus, the seed of the woman, I have good news for you. Jesus, the seed of the woman, is coming again and will come again in the fullness of time again to free us from the burden of the curse. And so throughout the Bible, we see this twofold narrative of redemption. We see, on the one hand, God extending an offer of fellowship to man. We see it with God's interactions with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and all the patriarchs. We see it with Moses and with Joshua and with David. Each of these are people that God puts his hand on, that God puts special favor on. And each of these are people who enjoy great fellowship with God. And then we see the serpent's attempts. This is the other half. If redemption is running across a train track through history, if you will, one side of that track, all right, one side of the ties on that track is God extending this offer of fellowship toward man, but the other side is the serpent's attempts to destroy the seed of the woman. We see this with Pharaoh. We see this with Haman. We see this in the corruption in Judah's family. We see this in the corruption in Josiah's sons and a bunch of other stories that I don't have time to get into this morning. We see how the serpent is constantly striving against the seed of the woman, against God's chosen people, and ultimately, he will bruise the Messiah's heel. And this is the twofold track down which redemption runs. The time was full for mankind. The time was also full for the nation, or for the tribe of Judah. I just want to give you some really quick highlights here of some different ways in which God was supernaturally superintending and guiding the line of Judah through which the Messiah would come. First is via the biblical covenant, and we really got into this in a lot more detail this morning, so I won't go into too much here. But we see throughout the Old Testament there are all of these different covenants, and something happens with each covenant that's very significant. I love it when I can find patterns in the Bible, and there are just lots of them there, because God is an orderly God. He's an intentional God. He does not do things randomly. And so with each covenant we see each of the major covenants that we see in the Old Testament, two things happen. One, each covenant points to the new covenant, the New Testament. Testament just means covenant, guys. The New Testament relationship between God, between Jesus Christ and his church. That's us. But each covenant also becomes increasingly specific and pointing toward the line of promise. Let me show you this. We have the Noahic covenant, which is in Genesis chapter 9. And this is basically God through Noah coming out of the line of Seth. Adam and Eve had many sons and daughters. You know the names of three of them, and the rest are not remembered. But Adam and Eve had many sons and daughters, and through one of those, through Seth, it was through which the line of promise would come. Every human being that lives on the earth today is ultimately descended from Seth, and via Seth, from Noah, because everybody else, they're dead. So, they didn't have descendants that lived on. So in the Noahic covenant, God promises that he will never again destroy the earth with a flood. He promises that never again will there be a global flood that wipes out all or most of life on planet Earth. So with the Noahic covenant, we go from the scope of all of humanity to the line of Seth via the line of Noah. Then we see the Abrahamic covenant, which comes some years later in the book of Genesis. And this is God's covenant with Abraham, that Abraham, out of Abraham were going to come mighty nations, and then all the people of the earth were going to be blessed through Abraham. But Abraham had many sons and daughters, and we know the names of two of those sons. We know Ishmael and Isaac. And there were actually other sons that came later after Isaac, believe it or not. God blessed Abraham in some very meaningful ways and gave him a lot of life and a lot of vigor. But Abraham had many children, but it was through Isaac that the line of promise would come. And so God makes this covenant with Abraham and says, out of all the descendants of Noah, out of all the descendants of Seth, and Noah and Shem, I'm going to pick Abraham. And then later on, he'll renew the Abrahamic covenant with Isaac and say, out of all the descendants of Abraham, I will choose Isaac. And out of the two sons of Isaac, I'm going to choose, not because either one of these guys are particularly great people, the Bible tells us, because they weren't. God chooses Jacob. And God says, I'm going to perpetuate the line of promise, the seed of the woman, through Jacob. And that's the renewal of the Abrahamic covenant, first with Isaac and then with Jacob. And then we move on down the line and we see the Mosaic covenant. And God says, all right, out of all the descendants of Abraham, I'm going to choose the nation of Israel. And he says, I'm going to take you out of bondage, and I'm going to make out of you a great nation. And this is the Mosaic covenant. It starts in the book of Exodus chapter 19, if you want to go back and read that. And he chooses the nation of Israel to be the nation through which the Messiah would come. And so this is really weird prophecy by this. I'm always amazed in the Bible how God uses terrible people. I mean, just awful people. I mean, if I was going to pick the people through which the chosen seed would come, I mean, Noah, he's like the most righteous man on planet Earth. I get that. All right. Makes sense to me. And we get to Shem. Shem's the good son. Okay. Fine with that. And we move on down the line. And I'm like, Abraham. Abraham's very righteous, loves God, has a few mistakes, but he's a very righteous man. I'm good with Abraham. Isaac, man, Isaac loves the Lord. This is fine. You know, he's not perfect, but he loves the Lord. And we get to Jacob. And I'm just like, God, what are you doing? You look at Jacob. Jacob is a liar. He's a deceiver. He's a supplanter. He's fleshly. He's not a great person. And yet God comes to Jacob and says, Jacob, I want to make a covenant with you. I want to renew my covenant with my fathers with you. So now I'm not just the God of Abraham. I'm not just the God of Abraham and Isaac, but I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then there's a story. In the midst, it's in Deuteronomy, and we're not going to get into all of that. But there's a story in the middle of the whole process of coming out of the nation, coming out of Egypt, coming into the Promised Land. They're passing through the children of Israel passing by the land of the Moabites I'm going to say I'm actually going to say Amorites on this one, but I'll go back and double-check the source material later today. But they're passing through, and Balak, the king of the Amorites, looks at them and looks at the nation of Israel and says, we got to do something about these people. They're going to be a problem for us. And so he goes, and there's this guy who's sort of a prophet for hire. They would call them seers back then. And basically somebody, you could pay them some money, and they would come bless or come curse an individual or a nation or whatever else. And this guy's, you know, his name is Balaam. And Balaam's not a nice person at all. I mean, he's not even a good person. And he takes money to do things. He's not really, you know, most of the time he's not really, God's not speaking through him. But he's billing himself as this prophet. He's willing to take money to curse God's chosen people. He has a talking donkey. Balaam's just kind of a weird guy, and you're like, God, why would you use Balaam? And yet every time Balaam tries to curse Israel, God gives him blessings to say instead, and Balaam has to say the blessings. He just can't help himself. And during one of these times, he says something very interesting. Let me see if I have this in here or not. I had like 6 hours of notes. All right, I don't have it here. And then I had to greatly parse down last night, and I was, that's always a stressful thing for a preacher to do, is like, okay, what do I not say? But basically says, you know, a star is going to rise out of Jacob, and a scepter is going to rise out of Israel. And basically, Balaam predicts the coming of the Messiah. Here's Balaam, he's a pagan. He doesn't know, at this point, nobody in Israel knows they need a Messiah. I mean, good grief, they're just started out as a nation, and things are going good for them, and Moses is still in charge. And, I mean, but Balaam, he was a pagan, through God through him predicts, and it's one of the most clear predictions in that part of the Bible, one of the most clear foreshadowings of the coming of the Messiah. And this all happens, this is all part of the Mosaic Covenant. Alright, so moving forward, we also have the Davidic Covenant, which is more specific. And God basically says, out of all of the house, and this is the subject of our message this morning, God says, out of all of the house of Israel, out of all the people and the tribes in Israel, I'm going to choose David and David's house and David's throne, and I am going to establish it forever. And so if you turn with me over to the book of Isaiah, chapter 9. All right, chapter 9, Isaiah says this. It says, for unto us a child is born. You know the words, unto us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Pay attention to this. Of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth to evermore. God makes a covenant with David. And most of the covenant is about the things that will come with his son Solomon. But at the very end, one of the things that he promises is that the throne of David will be established forever. The only person who can keep this part of God's covenant, the only person who can accurately fulfill it, is the king of whose kingdom and of whose increase and of whose throne, Isaiah says, there will be no end, and that is the Messiah, the person of Jesus Christ, the seed of the woman. So we see that God is preserving and building up to the coming of Jesus Christ through each of the biblical covenants, and that he's narrowing it down through time from all of mankind to the line of Noah, to the line of Abraham, to Isaac, to the descendants of Jacob, to one of Jacob's sons. And this is so cool that at the end of Jacob's life, in Genesis chapter 30, Jacob is blessing each of his sons. Well, he blesses some of his sons. He curses many of them because they did not leave moral lives. And he gets to Judah, and he gives Judah the blessing of the firstborn. And he says, the scepter... This is the time when Israel is not even a nation, let alone have a king, let alone has a scepter. He said, the scepter will not depart from Judah, or the lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh, and Shiloh is a Hebrew epithet used for the Messiah, until Shiloh comes. all this time before there's a nation to have a king or to have a scepter, God says the king, the ruling house of Israel will be Judah until Shiloh, until the Messiah comes. And it's at that moment that God is foreshadowing for us that the line of the Messiah comes through the house of Judah and by the Davidic covenant through the house of David. And so Joseph and Mary, who are both of the house of David, both direct descendants of one or other of Josiah's sons, who are both in perfect lineage, perfect line, when Jesus Christ is born, he inherits both the biological and the legal right to rule and reign on the throne of David. And this is really clearly shown for us in the chronologies in Matthew and Luke. And once again, for time's sake, I can't get into any of that this morning. But we also see that God builds to and preserves the line of Judah, build up to the seed of the woman specifically through the line of Judah. So Judah, here's Judah. He's not the eldest of Jacob's sons. In fact, he's the fourth born. The oldest three had already disqualified themselves because of their sin, and Judah's own family at that time was plagued with fleshliness. They were plagued with all manner of different problems, and it was not looking good for Judah to receive the inheritance of the firstborn. But then there's a story, and Joseph is involved, and there's a coat of many colors, and going into Egypt, and there's a famine, and we spent a whole week on this, and I really want to drill down on some of this stuff because it's exciting to me, and I just can't this morning. All right, but at the end of this, Judah offers himself as to be Joseph, who he doesn't know is Joseph. He also offers himself to go in Benjamin's place and to be Joseph's slave. He offers himself up essentially as a sacrifice on behalf of Benjamin, who at this point is the only person in the family who can challenge him for the rights of the firstborn according to the laws of that time and that place. And again, we got into all of this way more in the second lesson in the series, and I would really encourage you to go back and listen to that. But he offers himself up as a sacrifice for his enemy. And it's my belief that in doing so, we see Judah redeemed. We see him earn the position of the firstborn, and we see Judah go from being a fleshly man who doesn't really love God to being a type of Christ. Because Christ is the Son who offered himself up as a sacrifice for his enemy for the love of his Father. And then we see once again that God preserves the line of Judah through Boaz. When Boaz took Ruth, according to the Levirate law, we talked about this Levirate law that governed succession and governed marriage, and that it was a cultural law that God gave the Hebrew nation. It was later codified under the Mosaic law as a way to make sure that ancestry could be preserved, that there would be a line of unbroken heritage and succession from point A to point B, and that God ingrained this in this culture so that there would be this unbroken line from Adam to Abraham, from Abraham to David, and from David to Jesus Christ. And I don't have, nearly enough time to talk about that, and it's ground that we've already covered, and I'm going to get on to some new stuff here in just a moment. But it's a beautiful story, and in this story, in the middle of everything else that is happening in the book of Ruth, we see this kind of a beautiful story. We see Boaz, all right? Boaz is the Lord of the harvest. He's the kinsman redeemer. He's the type of Jesus Christ. And we see him take a Gentile bride so that he could redeem Naomi, who was the Jew. And it's this beautiful picture of God's relationship with the Gentiles and with the Jews, that both Ruth and Naomi, both Jew and Gentile, are in equal need of redemption. They both need a kinsman redeemer, and that it is ultimately through his Gentile church, his Gentile bride, that Jesus Christ will bring about the redemption of mankind. And it's such a beautiful picture. And again, I'm going like a mile a minute through this stuff, and those who have been here for the previous Sunday school lessons know that. And if you're hearing stuff you've heard before, guys, I do apologize. Let's get into some new stuff now. So At the end of the book of Ruth, we have a little chronology here. We see, now these are the generations of Perez. Perez, who is Judah's heir, and who would not have been born were it not for the Levirate law. And those of you who were there for that lesson know what I'm talking about and understand its significance. And the rest of you, I'm gonna have to plead with you to go back and read some of this or listen to the audios. But Perez, Judah's heir, fathered Hezron, Hezron fathered Ram, Ram fathered Amminadab, Amminadab fathered Nashon, Nashon fathered Salmon, Salmon fathered Boaz, and Boaz fathered Obed. Obed, who would again not have been born, were not for the same Levirate law. And so it's just an amazing way that God uses culture and God uses laws to bring about what he has planned. And it makes me wonder sometimes, it's easy to get frustrated with our culture, and it's easy to get frustrated with our laws and with the way things are around us. And certainly on some level, we have a way that we can impact and try to change those things. But sometimes I look at the stuff that I can't control and that I cannot change, and I have to wonder, with the perspective of eternity in mind, what am I missing? What is God doing here through sinful men and through sinful laws and through a broken culture that I don't understand? And that gives me a little bit of hope, right? It gives me a little bit of hope that even when there are things that I can't change, I can know that God is doing something with it. All right. Last point. The time was full for the Gentile nations. The world at the time of the birth of Christ was undergoing something called the Pax Romana. That means it's just Latin for the Roman peace. It was a time in history where the world was more peaceful. It's not that there weren't a bunch of wars going on. It's not that the world wasn't still a pretty dangerous place, because it was, but it was better than it had ever been. Right, the world was more peaceful, there were fewer wars, there was more trade, there was more connectivity between all the nations than there had ever been. The Alexander the Great had come in just a century or so before, and he had united all of Western civilization under a common language, Koine Greek, which is what the New Testament is written in. And so for the very first time, think about this, for the very first time in history, I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll come back to that. But so the Western civilization, they're united under a common language, and then the Romans come along. And here's the thing that Romans were good at. All right, Romans were pretty good at fighting. They're pretty good at toga wearing. But the thing that Romans really excelled at was building roads. Romans built roads that are still in use to this day in some parts of Europe. Alright, they were brilliant engineers, and they built roads wherever they went. What does a road mean? A road means that you can very much more easily, and in many cases much more safely, travel from point A to point B. You have something that's paved, that a wheel can go across without breaking down, which means you can take a wagon, or you can take a, you know, stagecoach, or whatever your form of, preferred form of wheeled transportation is. And you can get from point A to point B much safer and much faster than you could have otherwise. And so this is a really big thing. So the world is in a state of relative peace. We have a road system that by now stretches over most of the known world. And we have a long period of relative peace, very little expansion on the part of the Roman Empire. There's free travel, there's unhampered trade, there's very little fighting, and here's the thing that the Romans also brought. And I think, again, we go back and we watch some sword and sandal epics, and we think, man, everybody was just really mad to have the Romans in charge, because the stupid Romans are always coming in and telling everybody what to do. As it actually happened, most people liked it when Rome came in and told them what to do. Like, you know, maybe not Prince whoever who just got deposed, but like you and me, the guys on the street, because it meant that suddenly we actually have a police force and roads. And all those things that we take for granted in a civilized world, the Romans were the first people to bring these. So the world is still kind of a tumultuous place, but it's at more peace than it's ever been, except for this little place called Palestine, it's sort of an itchy spot in the right between the shoulder blades of the Roman Empire that they can't quite reach. Can't quite scratch it, and they're always having trouble with Palestine because for some reason these people just will not be happy. It doesn't matter what you do for them or how many of them you execute publicly, you just cannot make these people happy.
And so there was this guy by the name of Herod. Sometimes he's also called Herod the Great, though I don't really know why. He's also, you'll see him referred to in the Bible as Herod the Tetrarch. A tetrarch just means a tiny king, a minor king. Basically, he was brought in to be sort of like, you can be king of Palestine and Syria, but just so you understand, you still work for us. I mean, you're not really your own, you know, you can call yourself king, but you're more like a governor, is what it is. Well, side note here, Herod was a crazy guy. When you're reading through Josephus, as I know you probably will over your Christmas break this year, when you're reading through Josephus and you get to the part where he starts talking about Herod, he says, Herod was a madman who killed, Herod was a madman who murdered his own family and a great many rabbis. In other words, he was a really crazy guy, and his main thing that he was famous for was murdering people. He was not a nice guy. He suffered from chronic, and I would say probably we diagnose him today as mentally ill. He suffered from chronic paranoia and suspicion. He was very disturbed. And to understand, let's talk about how paranoid and disturbed Herod was at this point. Herod had just 20 years early before Jesus Christ, he narrowly survived an assassination attempt, because some things, Herod cockroaches, just won't die when you want them to. At the time of Jesus' birth, Herod had actually discovered that his son Antipater was currently plotting to assassinate him again. And additionally, Herod, I'm getting out of order here, and it's messing up the person who's doing the slides here. Sophie's, what are you doing? Alright, Herod, guys, just so you know, we'll talk about this in a minute, but he was crazy, he was unpopular, he was so unpopular with the Jewish people that he was afraid that when he died, nobody would mourn his death. So he basically had it in his will that when Herod died, all of the main elders and the leaders of the city of Jerusalem were to be publicly executed so that there would be mourning in the city on the day that Herod died. To my knowledge, this was never carried out. People were like, no. And we're not doing that. We're just not doing that. It's just not happening. He was just a crazy guy. And so adding to all of this giant frothing pot of crazy, which was Herod's brain, all right, the Magi from the east come to visit several weeks and several months after the birth of Christ. All right. Remember earlier I told you a story where a bunch of Romans were getting killed and you guys were like, what does this have to do with Christmas and should my children be hearing this? All right. This is where that's going to tie back in. In the Bible, when you see wise men or magi, as we have anglicized it, magi is the Persian. This is a Persian word which means somebody who is a magician or priest. And in the culture of ancient Persia, stretching all the way back to the time of Daniel, forward to the time of the birth of Christ, the magi were a hereditary priesthood who were the primary leaders of the Zoroastrian religion in Persia. And the Zoroastrians, by the way, they were monotheists. They believed that there was only one god, that his name was Ahura Mazda, and that there was also this evil god, but nobody was supposed to worship him. And so they were sort of dualists, and it's a whole thing. But basically, it was this false monotheistic religion that, you know, fire was very important to most of their, you know, you'll still see sometimes people on Persian stuff. If you go out and you look at Persian artwork, you'll see eagles and things like that. And that all has to do with the Zoroastrian religion. But the Magi were a hereditary priesthood who led the nation of Persia in the Zoroastrian religion. But they were priests, but they were more than priests. They also occupied the upper houses of government, and it was the body of Magi who were responsible for appointing a new high king when the old high king died. Now, I told you a story a little bit earlier, and in that story I said, take that word, high king, pin it in the back of your mind, because we're going to need that again. Well, pull that out now, because this is where we get to use it. The Persian or the Parthian Empire was made up of hundreds of little kingdoms. In fact, by definition, an empire has to be more than one country, right? That's what makes it an empire versus, you know, just a country. So the Persian Empire was made up of hundreds of little kingdoms. And each of these kingdoms were ruled over by these guys who were called kings or satraps. Well, at the death of the previous high king, all of these satraps got together, and there was a vote, and the Magi were responsible for deciding which one of you guys gets to be in charge of everybody else. And they very frequently would choose somebody, and that would not go well, go over well with the others, and they would fight wars over this stuff. And it was, it's the stuff of history books. I'm not going to get into all of it this morning. But the thing you need to understand is the Magi are responsible for choosing who is going to be the high king that rules over all the other kings. And so just a few weeks as Herod is sitting there on his throne with his festering awful Herod's disease, which is actually a thing, by the way, sitting there physically and mentally ill, and he's stewing, and he knows, man, Antipater wants to assassinate me, and he's everybody doesn't like Herod, and Herod is not liking them back, and all of this is happening, and then somebody says, hey, yeah, you know the Parthians? Yeah, you know those guys that you were actually brought in to drive out of Palestine 40 years ago? Oh yes, by the way, or actually 10 years ago, in 40 BC, alright, the Parthians invade Palestine and Syria and they take it over. So there's a time period in which Palestine is being ruled by the Romans, and then the Parthians come with their horse archers and shooting and the running and all that stuff happens. That all got started at the Battle of Carrhae, which I told you about a moment ago. Sorry, I'm getting worked up and rambling, and let me just center here for a moment. Okay, so the Parthian army comes in. The Battle of Carrhae starts a war, which the Parthians eventually win, and they take over Palestine and Syria. And in 40 BC, and that happens in 40 BC. Well, several years later, just about 20 or so years before Jesus Christ is born, Herod goes to Rome and says, hey guys, I have an idea. Give me an army, I'll go take it all back for you, and you can say I'm king, and in return, I'll let you rule Palestine again. And they said, okay, well, somebody should try. So he goes, and he comes back from Rome with an army big enough to drive the Parthians back. And so the whole reason that Herod is where he is today, the whole reason that Herod can be king, is because he is the one who is holding the Parthians at bay. And now the Parthians show up on his front door and say, hey, yeah, we're here to appoint a new high king. So could you tell us where the king of the Jews was born? The king of the Jews was actually Herod's title. And so here's Herod. He's already paranoid. He's already crazy. And then this happens. And the Bible says that Herod was troubled, and that when Herod was troubled, that all Jerusalem was troubled with him. And the reason was because whenever Herod was troubled, it means somebody was about to get their head lopped off. And so everybody was also troubled at this. Each of these, stepping back from all of this, I've gone way long, so I'm going to just wrap it up here. There's just so much more, okay? There's just so much more. Next Christmas, I promise. Stepping back from all of this, God uses each of these events to build together and to culminate in the birth of Jesus Christ. We see God using family legacies, using covenants, using culture, using laws, and using the marches of pagan armies, using the whims of pagan kings, using all of these different things to build up, to fulfill the whole body of prophecy, the whole body of foreshadowing that has been rolling like a snowball down the hill of history, and it's going to get to the bottom, and it's going to crash, and when it does, Shiloh comes. So God is using and has been using all of history to build up to this moment when the seed of the woman would come to cure us from the fall. And so Paul says, but when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. We receive the adoption of sons. That is the meaning of Christmas right there. If you don't take anything else away from this, and you can't remember any of the names of the empires that I just did a 20-minute tangent about, all right, remember this. Jesus Christ came so that we could be made sons. He takes the unworthy, and he makes them worthy. He takes the enemy, and he makes them the son. And so the message of Christmas this year is not if you're good, you get toys on December the 25th. The message of Christmas, so you know, is that you weren't good. You were already on the bad list. You didn't deserve it. And Jesus Christ came in the fullness of time to die for you, to free you from the law and to free you from your sin, to free you from yourself, and to make you a son or a daughter of God. I would encourage you to savor the joy of Christmas this year, but not for all the reasons that everybody else tells you you should savor the joy. Don't just savor the joy of Christmas because it's a good time to spend with friends and families, though it is. And don't just savor the joy because God incarnate was born in a manger. I mean, I feel kind of weird saying that because it is exciting and it's great. But in the first Christmas, Jesus Christ came to save us from the effects of the fall. But there's another Christmas coming. And it may or may not come on December 25th, and I will not amuse you by trying to predict dates and times. But there's going to be a last Christmas, and on that last Christmas, whenever that day comes, Jesus Christ is coming back with a host of angels and with a host of all the saints that have died and gone on to be with him, and he's going to retake creation. And he's going to free us, not from the fall, because he already did that when he died. He came once as a servant to restore a relationship, but he's coming again as a king to restore a kingdom. So Dad comes up for our invitation hymn. I want to sing a song that I think probably accentuates this truth about Christmas. And it always used to bug me that we sung this song at Christmas because it's really about the second coming. But let me tell you why I think it's appropriate. Because the meaning of Christmas isn't just that Jesus came as a baby. It's not even just that he died and rose again, though that's the central focus. But the meaning of Christmas is that he's coming again, and when he comes next time, he will be a king. And then we can say, no more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He, the seed of the woman, comes to make his blessings flow as far as the curse is found.
Stand, sing number 190.